WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
With me for a return visit to Fresh Air is comic Richard Belzer. As if his field wasn't already crowded enough, he's written a new book called How to Be a Stand-Up Comic. It's not guaranteed to land you a spot in your local comedy club, but it will give you a sense of some of the absurdities Belzer has found in the world of comedy. Richard Belzer has appeared on Saturday Night Live, The Tonight Show, and Late Night with David Letterman, and has had his own cable series and specials. At the beginning of his career, he worked as the warm-up comic for Saturday Night Live and was the MC at Catch a Rising Star, one of New York's top comedy clubs. He's appeared in many films. He starred in The Groove Tube and co-stars in the new films Freeway and The Wrong Guys. Richard Belzer, welcome back to Fresh
Air. Thank you. It's great to be here.
I want to go over some of the things you cover in your new book, How to Be a Stand-Up Comic. Now, you give the early warning signs of the stand-up personality.
Yes.
The first is, do you think the death of a relative is funny? So,
right.
Richard Belzer, do you think the death of a relative is funny?
Well, you know, when I was a kid, I always found humor in the most tragic things. If you have a child, not you personally, but if anyone out there has a child who does laugh at funerals, that could be one of the early warning signs of a stand-up personality. It doesn't mean that the child is abnormal.
But did that happen to you?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Like what?
Like what? What do you mean?
Do you laugh at a funeral?
Oh, yeah, sure.
What happened to you?
Well, I was asked to leave by one of the elders of the tribe.
Okay, here's another early warning sign of the stand-up personality. Do you enjoy doing impressions of handicapped people?
Uh-huh.
Did you do that when you were young?
Well, that's kind of more of a parody of what some comics do. It's kind of like a left-handed thing about Jerry Lewis.
Now, you did Jerry Lewis impressions when you were very young. I remember in our last interview.
That's right.
You told me that when your mother was beating you, you would sometimes try to distract her with
your impressions
of Jerry Lewis. Now, what appealed to you about him when you were young?
Well, one thing was that I was very frantic and manic when I was a kid. I was always talking, always getting hurt, and always in trouble. Plus, I looked remarkably like Jerry Lewis. I had a crew cut and just physically resembled him, and he was my idol. So I just mimicked him, you know. I probably did a better impression of him then than I do now in my act.
How does your impression of him now compare to the one you did then?
Well, now it's more biting and rough and kind of a put-down, whereas in those days he was my idol. Now that I've grown up, I see through the facade and see him for what he really is.
I mean,
a great performer, but... Well, no, it's just not a question of... The thing I do in my act is, briefly, what I don't like to perform in these contexts, but I say that Jerry Lewis was my idol when I was a kid, but then I recovered. I took Percodan and started doing Dean Martin impressions. And I do a thing about the telethon. I say that Jerry Lewis is on television once a year for 22 hours. I think that's enough, don't you? I mean... And then I go on a little further and get meaner.
In your book, you say the number one rule of comedy, thou shalt not steal. Have you ever had any of your routines stolen by another comic?
Unfortunately, I've seen my material on national television by a famous person who will go unnamed.
Oh, how horrible.
In my early career, I used to MC at Catch a Rising Star in New York, and I went on every night. I used to go on like at 9 to like 2, 3, or 4 in the morning, and I would bring up all the other acts, and I would... ran out of material about 5 minutes into it, so I'd have to improvise and, you know, experiment and do a lot of stuff. And I found this out later, but a lot of times comedians would send their writers to Catch to sit in the audience to rip off jokes from unknown comics and do, you know, write the jokes down, do little switches on them, and then sell them to more famous comedians who may not even have heard of the other guy. So it was weird to see something that you did on national television, and then if you did it again, people say, oh, you got that from, you know, that famous person when it was your own bit. That's the worst kind of feeling, because a joke is a precious thing, and to me it is anyway.
But you're defenseless, right? You can't copyright your jokes.
You can't. There was one case where I forget who was involved a few years ago, about 10 years ago or so, where somebody did sue someone about a routine, but I don't recall what the outcome was. It's hard to copyright because if you change one line, then it's not yours anymore.
You point out in your book that many comics are also super egomaniacs and that they have an entourage with them, and included in the entourage is the yes man, whose job it is to laugh loudly at all the jokes. Have you seen that, by the way, successful friends of yours?
I have.
Yeah?
Yeah. It's one of the saddest things in the world to see somebody who I knew when, you know, when they were struggling, and now there's five or six people around them, And every time they do a take, whether it's physical or verbal, two people fall over. Another one just looks with this knowing thing. And it's like this mindless idolatry that really dilutes the person's humor, to my way of thinking. I would think I like people around me who are critical and who are tough as far as an audience is concerned, rather than people who laugh reflexively just because you pay them. It's a big danger. I mean, Elvis could do it because he wasn't a comedian, so, you know, all the guys laughed at his jokes, but he wasn't doing them in Vegas or anything.
You take a couple of swipes at comics who have their catchphrases.
Well, kind of gentle swipes.
Gentle swipes, yeah. Yes. Now, I don't think of you as having any catchphrases, but you always do use the expression babe.
Babe, Sparky, or yeah, sure. I say that a lot. Yeah, sure.
Now, to me, babe, there's like two worlds where babe is used. One is show business and the other is retail.
That's funny. I never thought of it that way. I started using babe. People ask me, where does that come from? When the first time I went to California, I started in New York, my career, and I finally went to L.A. All my friends moved to L.A., and they said, you got to come out here. This is where the business is. And I hated L.A. I mean, I like it now, but in those days, I was allergic to it because I thought New York was the only place to be. And it probably still is, but aside from Philadelphia. But so when I went out there, I realized that this cliche show business thing of babe, everybody did say babe. I mean, agents actually, I thought it was like a Hollywood joke, this babe thing. But I was astounded that people who seemed sincere would say, and I'll see you, babe. And they like would everything would be babe. And I just thought it was so ludicrous and absurd and so insincere that I just adopted it and just started calling everybody babe and, you know, and using it in different intonations. You know, it could be, you could be, you know, you could scold someone by the way you say babe, or you could, you know, idolize them or dismiss them, or it's an all-purpose word.
Yeah, it works well.
Yeah.
Richard Belzer is my guest, and he's written a new self-help spoof called How to Be a Stand-Up Comic. In giving your advice to would-be comics, you tell them about surefire lines for hecklers,
mm-hmm.
and about three of them you could actually repeat on the radio.
Yeah, let's see if I can remember. Well, one that I really like is if somebody in the audience is bothering you, you say, sir or ma'am or whatever, say, I have a microphone, you have a beer, God has a plan, and you're not in on it. You know, that's kind of says it all. But the thing about hecklers is there are different kinds of hecklers. Some hecklers are mean drunks. Some really think they're helping you. Those are the most frustrating, you know. And then there's some that just, you know, want to be a part of the show. And then there are some that are actually very funny, and you have to be, you know, sharper than they are, just as sharp. So it depends on who the heckler is and the context of that show that night.
There are some great photographs of you posed as different kinds of comics,
mm-hmm.
Such as the 1950s jazz bop heroin addict found dead naked in the bathroom look, which
right.
is obviously your little homage to Lenny Bruce. But did you study all those comics when you were growing up, like really watch them and get down their styles and try to be like some of them?
Well, the thing is, when I was a kid, I really felt I was a student of comedy in the true sense of the word. I remember even when I was very young and I watched first on the radio and then later when TV came into existence, I would see a comic on TV and I would say, oh, that's a sight gag, he's getting away easy. Or I knew every little thing that comics did, you know, all the devices and techniques. So by the time I got, you know, to be a full-grown person, I had kind of the storehouse of knowledge in my mind that now, thankfully, I can use.
When you first started performing, were there comics, older comics, who you more or less wanted to overthrow, comics who you thought were either washed up or represented an old school of comedy that you were really tired of?
No. I have a certain reverence for those older guys. To me, I stand on their shoulders, and they may be corny and they may be outdated, but those were the guys that worked when comedy now is a glamorous industry. And, you know, there are this feature film Punchline's coming out. There are hundreds of nightclubs. Stand-up comedy is becoming a whole renaissance type thing. But, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago, there was, you know, a few hundred comedians. Now there's thousands. And there was these guys, you know, you call them Catskill comics, call them whatever you like. They worked like every night of the year. They had these great acts that they did. And they were real workhorses. You know, they had their tuxedo and their car, and they went to their jobs. And, you know, and now I'm a member of the Friars Club in New York. And I see some of these people at lunch. And it's great, you know, because when I was a kid, I saw them on TV, listened to them, and now I'm a fellow friar. So.
I remember in Comic Relief on HBO. Toward the end of it, it was co-hosted by Billy Crystal.
Right.
And toward the end of it, he said, I remember when we used to make fun of the people who did telethons, and, and here we are realizing how important it is ourselves. But it seems to me that, comedy, or at least Billy Crystal, is in the middle of this period of reconciliation with things that they used to make fun of in the world of show business or comedy.
I don't know.
I offer as further proof that he's co-starring with Alan King in a new movie.
Yeah, I know. Alan King, I did a film with Alan King.
Did you?
And he is the, between takes, he told the greatest stories. It's amazing. You know, because a lot of times from my generation of people, we're supposed to be really hip and cynical and, you know, the Saturday Night Live groove tube, or that whole anti-establishment. And then you grow up, so to speak, and you meet some of the people who were targets of our satire, and some of them are the sweetest, most talented, wonderful people, as square or strange as they may have seemed to us when we were, you know, doing what they called underground work, you know.
So that doesn't make you feel sorry for having ridiculed them, does it?
No. No, I didn't know any better, or we didn't know any better as a generation.
When you got started, you had a reputation of being a very aggressive, sometimes mean-spirited kind of comic. What did you do to win that reputation?
Well, as I said before, when I started, I worked in a nightclub called Catch a Rising Star, and I went on every night. And after running out of material, I had to turn towards the audience for material. And I would say, where you're from, or I'd say something about what they're wearing, or what do you do? And my style evolved out of dealing with drunken people at, you know, 12, 1, 2 in the morning, and trying to make be like an alchemist and get the lead out of their lives and turn it into gold and golden jokes. So I think part of my reputation stems from those days of when I was just very acerbic and cynical and improvising off of people in the audience.
It was more than that, though, too, wasn't it?
Well, like what?
Oh, like the kind the kinds of things you'd include in your routines.
Oh, yeah. Well, some of the routines were how should I say? But I don't think my material has changed in attitude as that much. I mean, I hear in the last couple of years that I've mellowed. I don't think I've mellowed on stage. I may be off stage. I'm more accessible, more diplomatic, and easier to talk to. But on stage, I think I'm just as vehement and cynical as I ever was, maybe even more so.
I've interviewed several women comics lately who all have the same complaint to make, which is that at the comedy clubs, that there are so many men doing this really sexist, misogynist material. And I wonder if you noticed that, too?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's despicable. And I think that one of the shameful aspects of stand-up comedy is that it's been male-dominated for so long, and there has been misogyny and chauvinism involved. And it's, I mean, I really admire and respect most of the women now who are in it, because years ago, for a woman to do stand-up, she had to put herself down and had to, you know, like Phyllis Diller and Joan Rivers were doing how ugly their husbands were, how ugly they were. And that, even when I was younger, not in the business, for some reason, that kind of stuff just didn't sit right with me. Now there's a lot of very bright, intelligent women doing stand-up, so it's like a whole new world. It's very refreshing. Because there's so many of them.
How do you draw the line between okay and tasteless, or between tasteless and offensive? I think that's the thing. Like, if you're doing a joke about women, a joke about gays, a joke about blacks or Asians,
right?
If you're going to include material like that in your repertoire, how do you decide for yourself if it's just like okay, tasteless, or if it is truly
homophobic,
yeah, I know exactly. What's the difference between like a good joke about a black person and a really racist joke, or a good joke about, you know, your wife or your lover, and a joke that is like really misogynist?
That's a very good question. It's really an ethical problem for each comedian to decide for themselves. I mean, I do jokes about AIDS, but I'm certain that it's not a homophobic joke. As a matter of fact, I'll tell you the joke.
Okay.
Well, it's not really a joke. It's true. I'm terrified of AIDS. I have AIDS hysteria. When I have sex now, I wear a condom, I wear gloves, I wear a surgical mask, and that's when I'm by myself. To give you an idea how terrified I am of that particular malady. So, no, but I see a lot of that, unfortunately, and you know, I rarely do this, but there's this one comic, I won't name the person, he does this really vicious, homophobic thing about AIDS, and it's almost like he's some Old Testament, you know, psychotic, you know, saying "see" and, you know, and just blaming people for the disease, you know, just the worst kind of thing. That, And I asked him, I said, well, you know, why are you so vicious about this particular thing? And he said, because it gets laughs. And that to me is, you know, is so it's such a mindless response. I mean, there are a lot of things you could do on stage to get a laugh, but I have this thing about quality laughs, vacuous laughs, meaningless laughs. I mean, there are comedians who go up and kill the audience, and I don't even smile once. And then there are others who, you know, well, it's in everything in between, but it's I think it's a personal ethical thing that, I know it sounds funny to talk about ethics and stand-up, but some of us have those.
Do you think that your standards have changed over the years?
My standards?
Standards in terms of when a joke is truly sexist or racist and when it's
absolutely. Just, I think I'm much more sensitive to certain things, particularly, you know, homosexuality and women. I can't cite examples, but I just know from how I've evolved as a person that I'm sure I'm more cognizant of people's feelings, even though I've been called, you know, rough and ready to hurt anybody. But
I've seen you do something very funny to, like, say something to someone in the audience who's wearing a yarmulke, and then say, well, it's okay for Jews to make fun of other Jews. And then you kind of clutch your heart as if God is striking you for saying it.
Yes.
but is it okay, do you think, is there a special liberty you have of making fun of people who are in your sexual or racial or ethnic group?
Again, I've seen people of particular persuasions, whether it's gender or race or religion, do jokes about the thing that they are, and they're just as racist or homophobic. You know, I mean, there's this one black comedian who does these terrible jokes about eating chicken and big butts, and, you know, and it's like, where is this guy coming from? I mean, it really. And then there are people who aren't of that persuasion who are much more sensitive and do jokes about, you know, blacks or gays that are funny and insightful and not that way. So it's a strange thing. I think sometimes people get mugged into acting out the stereotype they think the culture wants them to be, and that's very dangerous, I think.
Well, we're going to talk more, but first we have to take a short break. My guest is comic Richard Belzer, and he's written a new book called How to Be a Stand-Up Comic, and more after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Comic Richard Belzer is my guest, author of the new book, How to Be a Stand-Up Comic. He's also co-starring in the new film, Freeway. You know, we were talking about standards of tastelessness in humor, and you say in your new book that the thing that you can never make fun of is Frank Sinatra.
Yeah,
I was wondering how much truth was in that.
Well, people ask me, are there any sacred cows in show business? I mean, in stand-up comedy. And there is only one, and that's the chairman of the board, Francis Albert Sinatra. And I have advice in my book, if a comedian's on stage and for some reason a joke slips out about Frank Sinatra, you're immediately supposed to say, just kidding, Frank. And then take a beat and repeat it again. Just kidding, Frank. Otherwise, you'd be doing your act through a respirator and not a microphone.
Does it really come and get you if you say something, or are you just making that up?
Yeah, kind of.
Okay.
Well, I mean, he has this reputation of, you know, beating people up and, you know, being, I don't want to get in trouble, but I think you know what I mean.
Right. Okay. We've talked a little bit about how you've changed. One obvious way that you've changed, you dress really differently than you used to when you were starting out.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you're starting out, you had, like, long, stringy hair.
That's right. Beetle. And, Jay Leno used to say, Belzer, where'd you get the beetle wig?
And now, I mean, you know, you have, you know, nice styled hair, is I think what it's called, and like, really nice clothes. And I wonder what changed in you to
Money.
Bring about that. Was that what it was?
Money and having TV shows where you could steal the wardrobe. Kind of the two things. Plus, my wife has good taste. So between those three things, stealing a wardrobe, having money, having a wife with taste.
Another thing that changed, and tell me if you mind me bringing this up, from what I've read about you, you used to do drugs and so on.
Well, like other members of my generation,
in
the 1960s, I did, in fact, imbibe, as many of my peers did.
Yeah. No, the impression I got was that you were hanging out with Belushi and stuff when he was really in trouble, and that had changed you a lot. His death had changed you a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was. I don't want to talk about it.
That's fine.
Okay.
Okay. Moving right along. We're talking about insulting things to say about other people. What about self-deprecation? Will you really bring out vulnerable spots about yourself in a routine?
Will I? Actually, some of them I do, much to my own remarkable revelation. Yeah, so I occasionally do a bit about my childhood, where my brother and I, games my brother and I used to play, and we used to play Scary House, where we would, and this is true, we would take our bedroom, which we shared in those days, and one of us would go out of the room, and the other one would stay in the room and turn the room into a haunted house. And then the other kid would come in, and the other one would try to scare him. And what happened would, I'd come in the room. It's funny because when you go in the hall and wait, and you say, okay, come in, you open the door, the light from the hall reveals everything in the room anyway. So it's, I mean, what's so scary? I mean, you know the two beds, you know the dead turtles on the radiator, and you know the cowboys are on the wallpaper, and you know the linoleum's on the floor. So, but my brother did this one thing once. I came in the room, and he rolled a toy truck across the floor. So all you heard was the little wheels squeaking. And he said, it's very scary in here. There's monsters in here. You might even get in your bed and there might be a sharp object. And you might even get cut and a monster's going to wet your bed and you're going to be blamed for it. And there's sharp objects in it. You know, just... And we used to play these games. And it's, you know, that's about as vulnerable as I get, I guess.
Okay. You said that humor is sometimes about things that really scare you.
Mm-hmm.
What are things that really scare you?
Well, I mean, the culture. I mean, all of us, like the Challenger accident, AIDS, and there are things mm-hmm. that are going on that are incomprehensibly frightening. And I think that we reflexively make jokes about these things because we're afraid of them, not because we're mean.
What scares you politically right now?
Everything. This is the most terrifying. The last 8 years have been, for me personally, and I hope for other thinking, feeling human beings, a really bad, sad time for America. I think the Reagan administration has systematically disassembled some of the great things about this country and the government in terms of helping the disenfranchised and in terms of students, old people, farmers. Blacks have been totally written off. The military, as you know, is armed to the teeth with things that don't work. I mean, it's really, all the nightmares about Reagan are true, and I think it's starting to come out a little bit now, but he'll leave office, and I predict the next president will be a one-term president because it's going to be such a mess that they're inheriting that everything will fall on his shoulders. So in a way, that's why Mario Cuomo didn't run for president because he's too smart, and it would have been a step down to run, I think, and Bradley and Sam Nunn and people like that. But this is the first election, I think, where people don't want anybody to win. It's like nobody likes Bush, nobody likes Dukakis, and, you know, we were tired of Reagan, and it's like we're in limbo. There's a lot of uncertainty in the air.
Have you had to learn to do convincing caricatures of Bush and Dukakis?
Well, Mommy told me not to make fun of George, but George Bush, first of all, his name is really ripe for the press. If he's president, the headlines will be, Bush was trimmed today. You know, Bush went out on a limb today. Bush was burning, but it wasn't God's voice coming out. And his whole thing about not being a wimp and revealing every little thing that amazes me about this election is that each side is telling what they're doing to change their candidate to make them more accessible to the voter. I mean, if the person isn't accessible to begin with, now they're, you know, in a fake way trying to change them. I mean, it's an absurd situation that we're in because there's no more secrets. People are very media-wise, you know, the electorate. And I feel that no one's going to vote this time.
But can you do Bush and Dukakis? Do you
George
need to?
Bush, well, George Bush, I'm not a wimp. I am working on Dukakis. He's very hard to do.
Why is he hard to do?
It's just one of those voices that is oppressively ordinary and has like one tone to it, and there's no ups or downs, there's no inflection, there's no intonation. It's at least Bush has this whiny kind of thing that sounds a little bit like, you know, Liberace had a child with Jack Nicholson. You know, you could figure out. Most characters are conglomerations of other characters, but Dukakis doesn't sound like or remind me of anybody. I mean, he looks like Rod Serling. You know, he sounds a little bit like Joe Franklin, you know. But he's got one eyebrow and, you know, he's 3'11", so I don't know.
You do a lot of rock performers. You do Springsteen and Jagger and, mm-hmm. and Bob Dylan. Is it a fantasy of yours to be a rock star yourself?
Absolutely. When about 10 years ago, I had a radio show in New York.
Right.
And I had a little money. So I got a band. And when I did my concerts, you know, I did stand-up, but I also had the band. So I'd do Dylan and I'd do Springsteen and I'd do Jagger and I did all my singing impressions. It was great. It cost me a fortune, but it was fun. I think a lot of comedians are frustrated rock stars. And every rock star I know wants to be funny. So there's got to be a trade-off somewhere.
Maybe there's something science can work out.
Yeah, right.
some kind of crossbreeding. So have you ever done any of your impressions of rock stars with them in the audience?
Yes. On November 19th, 1979, at the Bottom Line in New York City,
I'm glad you remember that.
Yeah. I was on stage, and I used to close my act with my Jagger impression. And I came off stage, and the owner of the club came back and said, "Guess who's in the audience?" And I said, "Who?" He said, "Mick Jagger, and he wants to meet you." And he was very funny, and he was great. And a similar story happened. I used to do this bit about Roman Polanski renting Jack Nicholson's house, and then Nicholson has to go to court to testify about it. And I did that bit at the Roxy in L.A., and Nicholson was in the audience. And somebody came up and said, "Guess who's here?" And I said, "Oh, no." And I was afraid. But I figured if he's the Jack that we all know and love, and he didn't think it's funny, then I'm not going to like him. And he came up, and he had a big grin on his face, and he said, "I closed my eyes, and I thought it was me. You did a good job."
Oh, so I can never figure out, maybe it's because I'm so bad at it myself, how someone can really get the voice of somebody else. Does it come to you, or do you work at it hard?
It's interesting. Some voices I can do immediately upon hearing them, and others I have to really work on. Some are just I could never do, and some are easier than others. Like Nixon, for instance, I didn't want to. A lot of impressionists do an impression of another impressionist's impression. Because some people, it's easier for them to define the voice when they hear the exaggeration that someone else picked out. But with Nixon, I didn't want to do David Fry's impression because he did a brilliant one that was recognizable. And so I got a tape of a speech by Nixon, and I listened to it every day. I'd go for walks, and I'd listen and listen, and I'd try and I'd try, and I finally got his voice from him as opposed to David Fry. But I must admit, there are other voices that I've gotten by listening to other people's impressions. I mean, I don't do their material, but there's something about the voice that sometimes other people can define that you can't, and it's helpful.
Do you think of yourself as having a very distinctive voice?
I've been told that I do. I'll take that compliment.
Okay. Larry Gritt, we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for talking
you.
With us. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
My guest has been comic Richard Belzer, and you've probably seen him on David Letterman and Johnny Carson, Saturday Night Live. He's written a new book called How to Be a Stand-Up Comic, and it's just been published by Villard Books. Villard Books, thank you for the correction.
Division of Random House.
Okay. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.